And when these emergencies happen, people with disabilities are the first, unfortunately, to be left behind for many reasons. So just imagine that earthquake is happening, elevators stop working, and a person who is using wheelchair, how they can evacuate. 80% of people with disabilities worldwide live in poverty, and we all understand how poverty is connected to being even more exposed to risk to emergency situations. We looked at national climate policies, and we found out that almost 80% of national climate policies do not even mention people with disabilities. This is not okay. In the best case scenario, people think that people with disabilities can work on disability issues, and this is not correct. We can be part of the solution of global problems, not just the disability part of it.
Future Hacker. Life. Path. Future.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Future Hacker. I'm your host, Maria Taigi, and today we are talking with Elham Youssefian. Born blind in Iran, just months before the outbreak of the Iran-Iraq War, Elham's life is an example of resilience and determination. As a dedicated human rights lawyer, she has become a leading voice for the inclusion of people with disabilities in the global dialogue on climate change, focusing on emergency preparedness and response to environmental crises. She now holds a position within the International Disability Alliance, a coalition of over 1,000 organizations dedicated to representing the rights and voices of people with disability worldwide. Her efforts and influence were recognized globally when she was named one of the BBC's 100 Inspiring and Influential Women of 2023. Hi, Elham. It's amazing to have you with us today. How are you doing?
Hello, I'm fine. I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
Elham, as we usually do, can you share with our listeners about your journey, how it was to be a young blind woman getting access to education in Iran, your family and network support, and anything you find relevant that brought you to where you are today?
So, as you mentioned in your introduction, I was born right in the beginning of a war in my country. The country has just gone through a revolution, so everything was changing. And I'm the number three out of three children in my household, after two brothers. I have another older brother who is also blind. So I think the first challenge that I faced, even before I can notice it, was a family in a pretty traditional society with traditional roles for women, facing with the reality that they have a blind daughter. So I think it has been really challenging for them to think about what my future would look like, how I would be able to live my life independently, because the traditional roles that were defined for women were mostly like housewives, getting married, having children, and of course the probably the dominant thought process at that time was that no one wants to marry a woman with disability. And then of course women were working in Iran at that time. It's not like Iranian women were not like socially active, but mostly they were working as teachers and doctors. However, I assume that my parents didn't know how a blind person can even get education. So they had to deal with this, of course, with all this, what we call these days, a charity approach to disability that causes, like, people think that maybe you did something bad, that this is a consequence of your past sins that you're now having a blind child, or stuff like that. So that was the first. And then of course, at that time, sending children with disabilities to mainstream schools was not that common in Iran. So I was very lucky that I was born in the capital city, Tehran, where there were a number of specialized schools for the blind that I could attend one of them, because there were many kids who were blind that they had to just stay in a dorm. Like, imagine a 6-year-old child staying in a dorm to access education, but I could just commute from school to home and back. So that's how I got my education in special school for the blind girl in Iran. That's where I was born and the way I was raised. And then one interesting thing that I can tell you is about how we learned English. So of course, there were some English language courses in public education curriculum in Iran, but it was not really that progressive. My mom was specifically very interested for us to grow in our education, and by us I mean me and my brothers. So we were enrolled in a private English institute, which was like a private institution that, you know, based on payment. Of course, I assume that there was some resistance about how we can have a blind child here, because that was mainstream. And then the books in Braille were not available. So what happened was that my mom was reading aloud the books, and my brother, who was older than me, was just typing them in Braille using a Perkins Braille typer, and produced the books. I was lucky because I was a younger child, so the books were already there for me, and I was using them. So that's how we learned English. I attended that English private class for almost like 7 years, between ages of like 12 and 17, maybe it's like 6 or 5 years, yeah.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. And then in Iran, at that time especially, enrolling in public college was very competitive. We had a national entrance exam for public universities. And, you know, basically there were a million people competing for very limited chairs in the college. So I did pretty good, and I was accepted to do law in what was formerly known as Iran National University, or current name is Shahid Behesht University. So I started my education in law in Iran. And it was like, I mean, there were challenges. So many books were not available. There was a very interesting initiative by another blind woman who actually had established a personal studio where they were like recording on tapes like the books for college students. So some of my law textbooks were produced like that. Sometimes I had to borrow like notes from my classmates. Sometimes I was trying to record when professors were teaching, but some of them were not okay with that. They did not like me to record. I think they had some security concerns. You know, Iran is not like the most friendly country with human rights, so they were concerned that maybe something they say criticizing the government, it would be used against them if I record the, you know, the lectures and stuff like that. So there, I had that type of challenges as well. And then that brings us to when I was like almost like 21 years old, when I was attending school, like college in Iran.
So a question. So you're pursuing this career in law and human rights, and this is something ambitious for anyone. So is there anything specifically that motivated you to take this path? And, you know, you already talked to us regarding a couple of the challenges, but is there anything specific in your journey that motivated you going through this path for your career?
Sure. I mean, first of all, when I was studying law, I realized that very little has been done in my country for rights of people with disabilities. And, you know, Iran at that time. So I started my bachelor in law in 1998 and graduated with my bachelor in 2002. So at that time, there was not much happening about people with disabilities, and also about, like, there were tons of challenges that I was reading about, like, discriminatory laws and policies against women, and, like, democratic values that were not really fulfilled in the legal and policy system in my country. So I was feeling that, you know, that's an area that me as a woman with disability can really play a role. And then the first income in my life was through journalism. There was a nationally published newspaper in Braille, which was like a part of the Iran national newspaper. So it was published every day in Braille. It was very short, but through one of my friends, I could connect with people in the editorial, and I started a weekly column for blind women who were just readers or audience of that newspaper. So that also brought into my attention how I can do great to make sure that women with disabilities, people with disabilities, are aware of their rights, are asking for equality. And then there was another occasion that I would like to mention. So after my graduation from my first bachelor, I immediately started a master in international law in the same university. And then there was an occasion that, you know, one of the courses that we had to take was law of the sea. You know, we were studying how, you know, they delineate different zones in the sea, for example, continental shelf, you know, high sea and stuff like that. And then they were really map-based. So I do remember that in the final exam for that course, one of the questions that we had to answer was based on a map. And the professor had requested people to draw the line between two regions on the sea, where basically I cannot answer that question, and I couldn't even see the map. So usually the way that I took the exams was like I was asking someone, not necessarily expert, just a random college student, maybe like a literature student, I don't know, English language student, whoever I could find, right? The volunteer who would help read me the questions, I would just read, say the answers, and they would write it back for me so that, you know, the professor, the lecturer could read and could kind of understand, okay, and mark my response, right? So I was sitting in a, you know, and I was taking the exam in a separate room because it was, if I was in a main room, I would be disturbing other students because we had to communicate, we had to talk. So I do remember that I was sitting there, and then the professor came in and said, and I told him, look, I cannot answer this question, so can you just change it to another question for me, or at least explain the map for me so I can understand and I can try to respond. He said, no, I cannot change the question for you. You can answer as much as you can, and if you cannot, just don't answer. And it was like very discriminatory. It's not my fault that I cannot see. And you need to adjust the question. That's what we call reasonable accommodation. And then I was very sad that day. When I went home, I actually started crying, and I was feeling, oh my God, why? This is so discriminatory. This is not fair. And that was one of the occasions that I really felt I really need to work on this and make sure that the world is less discriminatory against people with disability like me.
Yes, yes, yes. That's a great story, Elham. And at the end, you had to go through all of those challenges in order to make such a big difference in the world that you're making today. And, you know, I'm glad that you have the grips for that. And so let's cover some points just to make sure that, you know, our listeners have the necessary background on the topic we're discussing, okay? So you advocate for disability inclusive emergency preparedness, right? So can you explain what this involves and its importance of communities around the world. Like, and have you have your personal, how have your personal experience influenced your approach to advocating for inclusive emergency responses and recovery strategies?
Sure. I mean, we all know that when emergencies hit, and by emergencies we mean disasters like earthquake, flood, cyclone, fire, war, widespread violence, that, I mean, no one can say they have never experienced or will never experience one of these things at least once in their lifetime. And when these emergencies happen, people with disabilities are the first, unfortunately, to be left behind. For many reasons. So just imagine that earthquake is happening, elevators stop working, and a person who is using wheelchair, how they can evacuate. Just imagine that there's a flood happening, and if the there is a loud siren going on, so everybody can understand, okay, there is an emergency. But if this person, how they can understand what they should do, where they should go. And just imagine that there are measures that someone needs to take to protect themselves. For example, we had COVID-19. And there's a person with intellectual disability. If the information is not provided in an easy to understand way, so that a person who has intellectual disability can understand, can follow, how they would be protected. So for these reasons, people with disabilities are most likely to be left behind. And also we need to remember that 80% of people with disabilities worldwide live in poverty. And we all understand how poverty is connected to being even more exposed to risk, to emergency situations. So for example, we know many people live in islands, small islands, and there are sea level raise happening. And usually the areas that are more at highest risk are the cheaper areas where someone who is poor can afford to live. So people with disabilities live usually at the front line of disasters. So I can go on and give you a lot of reasons why people with disabilities are at highest risk. And at the same time, the plans that are at place, including the preparedness plans, the response plans, and recovery plans, are usually not inclusive of people with disabilities. So for example, if I want to just clarify, we looked at national climate policy, and we found out that almost 80% of national climate policies do not even mention people with disabilities. This is not okay. And those who mention, don't mention in detail, just mention, yeah, governments need to protect vulnerable people, including children, women, and people with disabilities. And that doesn't help. The good and comprehensive national climate policy, national disaster policy, should include what exactly they're going to do and how exactly they're going to do to protect people with disabilities. So that's the problem that I am currently, in my current role, trying to tackle. Let me give you just one more example. We know that currently millions of people, over 100 million people worldwide, are displaced because of conflict, because of disasters, because of climate change, because of violence, and seek asylum, seek refuge. But for people with disabilities, this is such a tough journey. So one of the areas of my work is to advocate for inclusion and rights of refugees with disabilities. So actually, I want to share that probably when people are going to listen to this podcast, I'm no longer with my current role in the International Disability Alliance and have moved to a new role with another organization named International Refugee Assistance Project, which is an NGO providing legal support and policy support to make sure that everybody have access to safety everybody who is seeking asylum can access it on an equal basis. And my role is to make sure that people with disabilities are included in this process. So that's going to be my new role when people are listening and watching this podcast.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. So Elham, do you have, and I understand that you're currently working on a policy level, like, do you have access to any best cases, any good examples that you have seen actually applied and or any significant improvements that you've witnessed, or maybe a region or a country or a city that could be used as an example when it comes to being able to be more inclusive in those responses to people with disabilities? Or, you know, are we still on this regulation and policy level? And unfortunately, you know, we still don't have so much to share.
Well, actually, good policies are required to make that change. But yeah. I have to say that even those good policies do not exist everywhere. I just talked about the climate policies. So, for example, we have good climate policies at place. One example I can mention is some of the Pacific countries. For example, if I can mention one country, Vanuatu, which is a small country in the Pacific, has a very, very good and comprehensive national climate policy at place in terms of inclusion of people with disabilities. But in terms of how much this is implemented, this is something that we need to figure. Honestly, look, I am just one person working in the International Disability Alliance at the global level. I think there are many things that we need to do. First of all, of course, having these good policies at place. Then, of course, we need the inclusive budgeting, right? Because there are some additional expenses that we need to make. And when countries or NGOs or UN agencies are putting their budget at place, they do not consider disability inclusion funding requirements, we are not going to be able to implement those policies. Then we also need awareness and commitment. Look, there are many climate organizations out there, many NGOs, environmental NGOs, but how many of them are aware of what people with disabilities are facing? So that's exactly one reason that I really decided to choose my future role, like the new job, because that's a mainstream organization who wants to do something on disability inclusion. So I think if we see more of these things, that mainstream organizations that are not disability focused, but are working on climate change, on refugees, on disaster risk reduction, are feeling committed and are dedicating funding, dedicating capacities to include people with disabilities, that's where the change is going to happen. And of course, last but not least, we need people with disabilities themselves and their organizations to gain the opportunity for involvement and can play the role that they need to play, will be consulted in a meaningful way so that they can be part of the solution. And I just want to highlight one more thing. In the best case scenario, people think that people with disabilities can work on disability issues, and this is not correct. We can be part of the solution of global problems, not just the disability part of it. We can be part of the climate solution, part of the displacement solution, part of the armed conflict and violence solution. If we have the opportunity, if we have the resources we need, if the path to contribute is inclusive and accessible. So that's, I think, what we really need.
Yeah, that's definitely a major point, Elham, and I completely agree with you. So tell me, in your advocacy work, so how do you approach building awareness and empathy among those who may not understand the challenges faced by people with disabilities, which I believe is something very common, right? People are just not aware. And especially because most people don't have the opportunity to working directly with people with disability. So that's natural that it's not in, people's thought, people that are actually planning and building everything, right? So what's usually your approach to, being able to build this, empathy and awareness? You know, besides the logical answer that you already gave us, which is, you know, having more people with disabilities being part of being involved, right, in not only in government but organizations and companies.
So first of all, I use the right-based approach, language and approach in general. So it's not about oh, these are poor people, they are like vulnerable, you need to help them. I try to look into it and try to take them and help them to see this from the rights and equality perspective. And also from the contribution perspective, that people with disabilities are, like, according to World Health Organization's, 16% of the global population. So if you don't want to lose the input and contribution of 16% of world population, you need to make your work inclusive and accessible. So I use the right-based approach. I use the contribution approach. I try to give them real examples, like concrete stories, so it can be tangible for them. And also I try not to make it very specialized, because sometimes, you know, one argument that we hear is that people say, well, I don't know what to do. You know, it's a very specialized topic and I don't have the knowledge and expertise. I try to tell them, look, this is not very complicated. As long as you listen to people with disabilities, you look at the issue from the rights perspective, and you try to fight that stigma. You know, I sincerely believe that stigma and attitude about disability is one of the main reasons of discrimination and exclusion against people with disabilities. Because people think that people with disabilities are not capable. Like, even in a daily communication basis, like, many people don't even know how to talk to a person with disability. Like, as a blind person, even I face many people who, when they want to talk to me, they start raising their voice. They don't even understand, okay, this person is not deaf, this person is just blind. Or very easily talk to the person who is next, like, I'm walking with my friend, with my assistant, with my partner. And then people ask them what I need. Like, if I go, for example, to a medical appointment, happens a lot that they address the person who is accompanying me. Okay, what is her problem? Or ask her, put her to sit here, or ask her. And this is, trust me, this is not something that happens just not in the uneducated part of the society. It happens in many different levels, even at the highest level. That's just because lack of awareness. And I think, as much cliche as it looks, the best way to change these attitudes is exposure. People need to be exposed to people with disabilities. And don't make assumptions. Just try to understand that this is, like, people sometimes are scared when they see a person with disability. People, and then on the other side, we have this, like, people with, you are a hero, you are exceptional, you are like a role model for everybody, you are extra human, like a, I don't know, extraordinary person. Which is at the same time not correct, because we are just human beings. And I'm sure more or less everybody, if they acquire a kind of impairment and become a person with disability, they're going to find ways to cope with the situation. Some people do it faster, some people do it slower, some people do better, some people do worse, but eventually everybody will find, and this is part of humanity, human nature, you're coping people, like individuals. So yeah, I try to change the attitudes.
Yeah. So here in Brazil, we do have a couple of laws around inclusion and, disability. I'm not sure if Brazil is a case at all, a global case at all or not. And, it's by ignorance, but we do have a couple of laws to guarantee that not only, you know, everywhere people go, it's accessible, physically accessible, But companies, depending on the company size, there's these quotes that they have to fill with people with disabilities. So for example, company with around 100 to 200 people, they need to have 2% of their payroll should be with people with a disability. So usually working with quotes, it's controversial, right? I don't know what's your view on that. I usually see it positively because if we have a market that is very unbalanced, I think it's a way to push for more equality. And then I do hope that some days we don't need to do that because of a law, but you know, just because it's fair. But anyway, so what's your view on that? I'm just curious, like around having legislation that puts quotes on companies and organizations. So, you know, people have to sit and think seriously thinking about that, because it's not just about hiring someone, but giving the access and giving the tools and giving the correct environment so people can actually do their work, right?
So, I mean, this can be acceptable solution only and only if it is accompanied by other measures. Because otherwise, first of all, companies are gonna find ways to get away with it, you know? They hire somebody and then that person is identified as a person with disability, but the reality is not that the person is not a person with disability. All people with disabilities will be isolated to a certain job. Like, for example, many blind people are being forced to be in the roles that they take phone calls or like answering phones and or things like that. So these type of measures are good at temporary level only if they are accompanied with some national campaigns to support companies to become more inclusive and accessible for people with disabilities, and also accompanied by programs and policies that make sure that people with disabilities are gaining skills. So sometimes it's not just about the companies not being inclusive and accessible, but also people with disabilities not having the skills required in the society to be like equal and interesting employees, right? You as an employer need to think, oh, this is a good person. This person will be able to do what I want and be interested to hire me as a person with disability, not just feeling, oh, I have to hire her. So let me just put her in a corner and give her some salary so I don't get the government sanction because of that. So it's like a multi-layer national program required to ensure that people with disabilities are really part of the job market. And also it's about families, you know, encouraging families to make sure that kids with disabilities are educated, because many families hide their children with disabilities, especially girls, or don't really invest on their education. Many schools do not register kids with disabilities, so the child cannot access education. So if you are not educated, how you can work, right? No matter if the government puts whatever quota at place, if I'm not educated, if I'm not skillful, what can I do? I cannot do anything, right? So it should be like a multi-layer and multi-dimension work and work plan at place with dedication of funding, getting like the education, the national TV, like campaigning and all of that to change this. Otherwise, just one quota will not change anything.
Yes, I completely agree with you. So with all those technological advancements, there's so much potential to improve the lives of people with disabilities. Are you optimistic about those developments becoming actually accessible to all? And adding to that, what role should governments and organizations play in ensuring that those advancements are not just available, but also affordable and user-friendly?
So, yes, technology is progressing. However, not all technology is accessible. So I think the first thing that needs to happen is that accessibility is on the top of the checklist of any new technology that is being developed and especially supported by governments. So we have this concept called universal design, which is also embedded in the Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities. This means that anything that is being designed should be designed in an accessible way that everybody can use it, including those with different sensory impairments, blind, deaf, hard of hearing, those with visual impairment or partially sighted people, those with deaf blindness, those with intellectual disabilities, so on and so forth. So the first thing is that we really need to make sure that all this new technology considers accessibility from the very first day from scratch, rather than building a technology and then, oh my God, this is not accessible, let's do something about it. So that's the first thing that is required. So governments need to make sure that they only support technology that is fulfilling and meeting the accessibility requirements. And of course, it will make a change. Right now, like Luke, the reason I can participate in this conversation is that I do have the screen reader software that helps me to log in this meeting, to make plans, to contact with you, to answer to your messages because of the information and communication technology. So it is important that like companies invest on accessible ICT, like information and communication technologies. There are a lot of conversations about artificial intelligence and how it will impact rights of people with disabilities. I'm not like really closely following that conversation, but I think this is something that we really need to think about and discuss further. The UN Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities published a report a couple of years ago on artificial intelligence and disability rights. This is a very good start point. I think it is a new area that I hope that disability rights advocates would prioritize in this world, in the work that they're doing, because the future world is the world of artificial intelligence. And it is important to think about and advocate for disability inclusion now, rather than wait for non-inclusive AI technologies to be at place and then we start to protest and object and say, oh my God, this is not accessible, you should do something about it.
Yeah, exactly. But at the end, I'm sorry to push for this answer. Do you feel we're doing enough to move on the right way, on the right path? With everything is happening now, right? And here in Future Hacker, we already shared so many concerns regarding ethics and making sure that we're doing everything in an inclusive way. But it seems to me, when we see companies moving forward without the needed legislations and rules in place, that we're still lagging behind. For some reason, when it comes to disability, and before talking to you, naturally, I would feel that optimistic just by thinking about all the access that people that would be able to have by having technologies that can. You gave this example of the reading devices. So people that cannot walk, they have all the virtual world being developed so people can actually do meetings on the metaverse and things like that. And those are technologies that are way far from being accessible. So my feeling is that we have a lot of potential thanks to technology. But if it's being thought, if it's being really worked with the goal of being accessible, that I don't know. I do know that the potential is there. And we can do a lot of improvements, but if it's actually being worked the way it should be, that I don't know, right?
Well, honestly, first of all, I don't think so. I don't think that we're doing enough in terms of making the new technology accessible, but I want to raise something else. even though the available accessible technology, how many people with disabilities do you think they can have that? They can afford that, right? How many people with disabilities have a job that they can purchase this equipment? How many governments are putting this type of technology at the disposal of people with disabilities, right? And let's go back to the people that I specifically work with, like people who are impacted by emergencies. Like assistive technology is a big issue. Many people who are affected by emergencies do not have access to assistive technology. So making the technology that is being developed accessible is one thing. Making it affordable for people with disabilities is another thing. And then when it comes to screen reader and things like that, like many people with disabilities do not know how to use this technology. So that's also another issue to share the knowledge and expertise of benefiting from the technology is another layer. So no, of course we are not doing enough.
A lot of work ahead, right? So I know that we have you know, there's a time sensitive today, so I'm being aware of the time here. So I have two last questions for you. So one is, you already mentioned that, you know, by the time that this interview is live, you're going to be working on the refugees cause, right? Besides that, is there any future goals that you have, any special plans that you could share with us?
Well, now that I'm focusing on refugees, I really hope to try to make a change in this area of work that I even be my focus for the near future. I mean, I do have dreams. One of my main dreams is to do and to establish an organization to support women with disabilities in the MENA region, in the region that I am from. Because I really think that women with disabilities there are really like excluded and marginalized. So one idea that I always had is to establish an organization to provide like support for them, the growth opportunities for them to access education, to access the assistive technology that we were just talking about, to learn how to advocate for their rights and to make sure that they are fighting for their rights and for their equality within their societies, within their families. Like, look, for women with disabilities, challenges are very complicated. So we know that women with disabilities are at highest risk of gender-based violence, and they're very unlikely to be able to report that. They do not have equal rights when it comes to marriage, to divorce. Like yesterday I was reading a report about how even in the European Union, they lost the opportunity to approve a directive that prohibits forced sterilization of women with disabilities. You know, in many countries this world, reproductive rights of women with disabilities are being extremely limited. So these are areas that I really want to work on for future.
And, you know, as a final word, do you have any, you know, final message to the listeners out there? Maybe anyone that is listening to us and would like to get more engaged on the disability cause or you know, is more interested about learning more, or maybe someone with disabilities listening to us. So if you have, you know, any final advice on your side or any message of inspiration, you know, the final word is yours.
Sure. I think there is not a single human being in this world who cannot do anything to make sure that people with disabilities are further included in the society. Even if when you're posting a picture of yourself on social media, writing an alt text for that picture, which means you describing the main things about that picture using the alt text feature, makes the world more inclusive and more accessible for people with disabilities. If, for example, whatever role that you have, whatever job you have, wherever you are, there are many things that you can do to make sure that the world is more inclusive and accessible to people with disabilities. Just find them and take action now.
That's perfect. Elham, thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for being here with us today. Everybody, thanks for listening.
Future Hacker. Life. Path. Future.